This is Jim Inkster coming today on Talk Louisiana. We'll visit with veteran LSU law professor Paul Beyer. He's taught abroad with former U.S. Supreme Court Justices Harry Blackmun and Antonin Scalia. And Professor Beyer, who's been at the Old War School since 1972, will preview Monday's announcement by President Trump of another nominee to the Supreme Court, this one to replace Justice Anthony Kennedy, who retired last week after 30 years on the High Court. Also, Baton Rouge businessman Kevin Lyle and his wife Renee Chatelain, they'll discuss Kevin's Tony Award-winning production Once on This Island. Lyle took Broadway by storm. The Baton Rougean won the Tony Award last month as producer of his musical. Chatelain, of course, heads the Greater Baton Rouge Arts Council. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Your number is 877-217-5757. Locally, 297-5633. And please send us an email if you'd like to talk at talklouisiana.org. We begin with Dr. Paul Beyer, a legend at the LSU Law Center, where he has held court for 45 years. Actually, yeah, 46 years now. He came in 1972, BA University of Cincinnati, summa cum laude, JD Harvard University, where he was the editor of the Law Review. And he is a man who has done LSU proud for many, many years, and he has also rubbed shoulders with some of the biggest luminaries in the legal world, including Supreme Court Justices Harry Blackmun and Antonin Scalia, both of whom have now passed, but they taught abroad with Professor Beyer. And Monday, Donald John Trump, I think at 10 o'clock our time, is expected to announce, not expected to, he will announce his nominee to the U.S. Supreme Court to fill the vacancy left by the retirement last week of Justice Anthony Kennedy. Professor Beyer, good morning.
Well, Mr. Inkster, may I call you Jim?
Please.
I thought so.
Please. And a man who's a first-generation American, too.
That's right. My parents were German immigrants, came to this country freely without restriction.
When did you learn English?
I went to school. I remember I went to kindergarten and fifth grade. I fell in love with my fifth-grade teacher. She shunned me, but that's how I learned English. I learned German in the kitchen.
I bet you did. German was your first language, wasn't it?
No. I'm a first-generation American. So, in other words, I went to public schools. But at home in the kitchen, my mother and father, God bless them, they spoke German. And so, therefore, because I knew some German, I took German in school and earned an A.
Well, they must have gotten out of Europe just before the bad things happened with the Third Reich.
That's correct, fortunately.
And came to where?
Well, my father was a coal miner near Bremen in the Ruhrgebiet. So he thought it'd be a good idea if you're going to immigrate to America to go to West Virginia to continue coal mining. The technology was quite different. My father was very small, so he couldn't do it. So then they left and they went to a nice German town called Cincinnati. And he got a job at Procter & Gamble.
And you went to the local university.
I did. I went to the University of Cincinnati. I lived in Cincinnati. I got up and I walked to school for 4 years. I enjoyed it very much.
Did you ever go to Crosley Field?
I did once. As a matter of fact, my dear sister, Ruby, she dated and courted Pete Rose. But fortunately, that didn't last.
Peter Edward Rose, who got 4,256 hits, more than any other major leaguer, played on more winning games, in more winning games than anybody in the history of the game. And he, of course, has had his legal issues. But we're here today primarily to talk about what happens with the High Court, with Justice Kennedy, the so-called swing vote, retiring. This is a huge appointment coming.
It certainly is, and my whole life has been dedicated to watching the court, teaching the Constitution through, well, I'm in my second generation, so it's been quite a challenge, but a real exciting adventure. And that adventure continues with Donald Trump. As you said, Donald John Trump, he's got quite an appointment, and he will make the most of it, believe us.
He is going to turn out almost by coincidence to be a formative president. He's had one appointee, and the appointee has been everything conservatives wanted in Neil Gorsuch. Remember Justice Souter. He was appointed by President Bush and was thought to be a conservative and then became anything but a conservative. Those things probably won't happen again.
I agree with you entirely. But in the old days, ideologues, the choice of an ideologue was left behind. Now it's center stage. And I must say that the Federalist Society has had a lot to do was shaping, after about 30-some years, the court. They're coming around to victory with the Gorsuch nomination, that was to be sure.
Well, Dr. Beyer has delivered many memorable speeches in and out of the classroom through the years, and there's actually a book, Speeches by Paul R. Beyer. And this one is from April 22nd, 1993, to the New Orleans Bar Association, and it's called The Changing Supreme Court. This was right after Clarence Thomas joined the court. You knew then that the court was going to have a change. What was your perception then that has been proved true today?
Well, look, when you replace Thurgood Marshall with Clarence Thomas, you got different judicial philosophies coming on board. The whole struggle, as I've seen it over all these years, is between justices who consider liberty and equality an evolving concept, and then you have Antonin Scalia, who considers the Constitution and its words such as a mosquito frozen in amber. So between the restraint school and the school that Justice Breyer has labeled the school of active liberty, there's always this tension and debate.
Well, it is hard for many to believe that Justice Blackmun, who you taught with, he wrote Roe v. Wade. So many people automatically think this must be one evil individual. And then Justice Scalia, of course, was the most conservative member of the court, but yet his best friend was Ruth Bader Ginsburg. How does this happen when people... it actually, I think, is a good thing, but unfortunately in the political process it doesn't happen anymore, but people of wildly different political persuasions can turn out to be fine people, independent of their views, whether you like them or not.
Well, I think the Ginsburg and Scalia friendship is born out of their personal characters. They're both delightful individuals, and so they get along. They have to. I mean, if you're named to the Supreme Court, you sit with eight colleagues for life. So you might as well have some joy with them, and that's true with Ginsburg and Justice Scalia.
Scalia, of course, died, and President Obama named a successor, and the U.S. Senate sat on that nomination for more than a year, Merrick Garland, who didn't even get a hearing. Was that unfortunate?
Well, it was unfortunate because politics intervenes and stops a presidential selection. But from my point of view, a teacher of the Constitution, that restraint and break is built in. The framers said that the Senate would have the role of advice and consent, and if the Senate disagrees with the president, they can kill his nominee.
We're visiting with Dr. Paul R. Beyer, LSU professor of law since 1972, came this way by his education at Harvard University, 46 years, and are you shooting for 50?
Well, I told you, Mr. Engster, when you asked whimsically, well, how long are you going to be on the court? I said, well, I'm going to serve for 75 years to set a record, but I realize that that is going to be impossible because, as I told you, by that time, I'll be eating dandelions by the roots.
But you're not stopping, and that's good. I love it. And one thing, whether you like President Trump or not, he is a vibrant 72-year-old man. He certainly is full of vim and vigor, gets up early every morning and starts his tweeting, and he doesn't seem to stop until late at night. God blessed him with a lot of energy, and let's hope that energy is used for good purposes. Is there any possibility that he might pull a surprise come Monday?
Well, he's full of surprises, so I would not discount the possibility that with all this talk about Amy Coney Barrett, he might name Senator Mike Lee from Utah, but I doubt it. I doubt it. I think he's narrowed the list. Monday, when he does this for the United States, is going to be the equivalent of his moderating The Apprentice, I'm sure. Show business.
Oh, yeah. It'll be a show, and he knows how to do it and do it well. And Amy Coney Barrett, who went to Notre Dame, is a native of New Orleans, went to Dominican in New Orleans. She was born in 1972, so she, at 46, could be on the court for 75 years. Well, mm-hmm. she could be on the court for 50 years or 40 years easily. That has to be a consideration. President Trump, well, he's big on legacy. If he wants to have a big one, it would be important for him to appoint a young person.
That's correct, and she's also a woman.
That's true, and we do have three women. The other day I said two, but there are three. There are two appointed by President Obama in Kagan and Sotomayor, and of course, Ruth Bader Ginsburg by President Clinton. This would be a woman from the right, though. And she is on record as saying she is thinks Roe v. Wade is bad law.
She said it was erroneous, and that concerned me when I first read it. It certainly concerns Senator Susan Collins of Maine. But then I read another pronouncement later from Judge Barrett, and that is she said Roe v. Wade is settled law, which cuts both ways.
Mm-hmm. And Brett Kavanaugh, who is on the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia, some believe he is the favorite, he is on record as saying the president may have the right legally to pardon himself, so that this could be fascinating if he appoints Justice or Judge Kavanaugh.
Assuming there will be need for a pardon.
Assuming that. 877-217-5757 is your number. We're back with Professor Paul Beyer of the LSU Law Center after this quick timeout on WRKF. This is Jim Eagster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757. The legendary law professor from Louisiana State University, Paul R. Beyer, is with us 46 years at the old war school. And he is here to talk about what's going to happen with the Supreme Court come Monday, and the opening created by the retirement of Justice Anthony Kennedy. Now, Paul Beyer has taught abroad with both former justices, now late justices, Harry Blackmun and Antonin Scalia. He also edited the works of one Justice Hugo Black, going back a long ways. How did that happen?
Well, I was called to the Supreme Court. This was a gift from God. I worked at the court as a judicial fellow. Nobody knew what that was, but I had a year inside the court. Mrs. Elizabeth Black, who was Hugo Black's widow, was there. She was a friend of Chief Justice Berger. And that led to Elizabeth calling me when I returned home to teach. And she said, I'm trying to publish a book, my memoirs. And how about LSU Press? And I said to Mrs. Black on the telephone, I don't know, but if you could send me the manuscript. So she did. And I called her and I said, Mrs. Black, we weren't on a first-name basis then. This is a love story, and also you have some of the court developments in it, so I'll be happy to help you as an editor.
Okay, well, beautiful. Your presentation, by the way you speak, and I mean this as a compliment, it reminds me of Justice Berger, the cadence and the resonance.
I don't have the deep, deep, deep voice, Paul, of Chief Justice Berger, but I did work with him. And I enjoyed his company. He was chilly. He had the veneer of the Chief Justice. He knew that position. But on Saturday morning, he'd cook soup for everybody.
He went to the court as the Chief Justice, I think, just as John Roberts did. That is an interesting position. You're on the court, nine members. I'm sure Scalia probably wasn't all that wild about Justice Roberts being the Chief Justice, but he was.
That's correct.
877-217-5757. We're going to get some of the cases that the new justice could be intricately involved with and perhaps be the swing vote, but we have some people waiting to talk with Paul Beyer. Professor Beyer, here's Dan downtown. Dan, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana with Paul Beyer.
Yeah, Professor Beyer, given that Scalia had two sons working in the Bush campaign and Clarence Thomas, his wife, as well, should they not have recused themselves from Bush v. Gore? And there would have been a 4-3 vote to actually count the Florida vote.
Well, recusal of a Supreme Court justice lies in the lap of each judge who's challenged. And there is no other control. That may change. I think there's room for change. But in those days, the answer to your question is he didn't have to. Should he have? Scalia would tell you, of course not. And he'd say it loudly.
877-217-5757. A listener at talklouisiana.org says, Professor Beyer, do you think it's appropriate that justices have Supreme Court justices have lifetime appointments?
Indeed, I do, and I think that's central to the work of the Supreme Court. The framers were wise to do that because it's the only branch of government where you have lifetime tenure during good behavior, and that's important for the law. Mm-hmm. Because you have permanence.
All right. Stephen Dixon, a good lawyer himself, says, please ask Professor Beyer if he's read enough of Judge Barrett's cases to outline her judicial philosophy.
Stephen Dixon is a delightful lawyer. He's my student, as a matter of fact. No, I'm sorry, I haven't explored Judge Barrett's record. I don't know. But that's the purpose of the framers saying the Senate will have hearings to explore all these matters. And when you have an appointment such as this, one of the most exciting classrooms will be the Senate Judiciary Committee exploring all these issues.
877-217-5757 for Paul Beyer. Randy and Zachary. Hi, Randy. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Hi there, Professor. As I recall, President Eisenhower was not very happy with the people that he appointed to the nominated to the Supreme Court.
Justice Earl Warren in particular.
Well, Randy, I must say you're well-educated, quite right. President Eisenhower actually said, during my administration, I've made two mistakes, only two, and they're both sitting on the Supreme Court.
Who was the other one?
Chief Justice Warren and William J. Brennan, Jr., who was considered to be a worthy Republican. And William Brennan really is responsible for an elaboration of human rights.
Mm-hmm.
That was his legacy, and it was a great disappointment to President Eisenhower, but not to me.
Now, Whizzer White, Byron White, football star, Colorado rugged, kind of a Marlboro man type.
That's right.
Appointed by Jack Kennedy. You could see they were both born in 1917, a few days apart. You see how Kennedy would have loved this guy, but he turned out to be a much different type of justice, I'm sure, than Jack Kennedy thought.
That's correct.
In fact, he was one of the dissenters on Roe v. Wade.
He also dissented in what has become established law, Miranda versus Arizona. Justice White said, well, there's nothing in the Constitution that requires the police to inform somebody in custody of their right to remain silent. And Justice White actually said that that would impair law enforcement. I asked my colleague, my dear friend Cheney Joseph at the time, did he believe that Justice White's dissent was solid? And Cheney, who teaches criminal law, said, of course not.
What about gay marriage? Justice Anthony Kennedy was a big vote on that, and the swing vote. And now with him gone, a more conservative justice might see things differently.
Well, that's true with respect to gay marriage. I don't anticipate Roe versus Wade to be overruled or jeopardized. But on gay marriage, that was really quite a struggle all the years. And here's Justice Kennedy, who finally sides with equality and liberty expanding to embrace the gay community. If I might, just for a moment, this is Justice Kennedy, the opening of his opinion in Obergefell.
That's the decision.
This is Kennedy's words, and I'm going to contrast them to Chief Justice Roberts, because the two schools are here. The Constitution promises liberty to all within its reach, a liberty that includes certain rights that allow persons within a lawful realm to define and express their identity. That's true of Justice Kennedy. He's very concerned about the individual's identity. Justice Kennedy wrote plenty of opinions that were lead-ups to Obergefell, and he winds up his opinion this way, and this was in 2015.
Yes.
Yes, June 26th. He said this, No union is more profound than marriage, for it embodies the highest ideals of love, fidelity, devotion, sacrifice, and family. And he wound up by saying that these individuals, Obergefell and company, their hope is not to be condemned to live in loneliness, excluded from one civilization's oldest institutions. They ask for equal dignity in the eyes of the law. The Constitution grants them that right. Now, let me quickly turn to Chief Justice Roberts, because here's a school of activism, of equality and liberty that expand. And then you have Chief Justice Roberts, joined by Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas. They dissent. And what Chief Justice Roberts said is plainly that the court is not a legislature. It doesn't make law. It only speaks the law.
Alito was also one of the dissenters.
Yes. Incidentally, that business about you only speak the law, you don't make it, that goes back to Justinian. They don't disarray. They speak the law. They don't dare. They don't make it. Chief Justice Roberts said this: the legitimacy of the court ultimately depends upon respect for its judgments. And that respect flows from the perception and the reality that we exercise humility and restraint in deciding cases according to the Constitution and to the law. According to Chief Justice Roberts, there was no humility. There was hubris.
Okay, we do have to pause, but we will return with the erudite Professor Paul R. Beyer. 877-217-5757 from the man from Cincinnati and Harvard University who's been at LSU for 46 years. We're back after the news on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us. Ali Baltazar is producing. You're listening to Talk Louisiana on WRKF. If you'd like to join the conversation with Professor Beyer, who'll be with us for a few more minutes, 877-217-5757. Paul Beyer, professor at LSU's Law Center for 46 years, graduate of Harvard University, where he received his degree. And when we went to the break, you were reciting the words from Justice John Roberts, Chief Justice, who wrote the dissenting opinion in the Obergefell case, which made same-sex marriage the law of the land. He is one of those original theorists who believe that the Constitution is the Constitution. It's not a living, breathing document. And we have this collision of philosophies quite often at play on the court, don't we?
That's correct. And this is how the Chief Justice finished up his dissent. I don't want to slight him. If you favor same-gender marriage, then celebrate. Celebrate the achievement of a desired goal. Celebrate the opportunity for new expression, for new benefits. But do not celebrate the Constitution. It had nothing to do with it.
You're an Ivy Leaguer, and every member of the court is a graduate of an Ivy League law school. Now, if it's Amy Coney Barrett, she's a graduate of Notre Dame, which is, last time I checked, was not in the Ivy League. But my guess is that it will be Kavanaugh is the choice for President Trump. That's just my guess, and I think he is an Ivy Leaguer. So is there a discrimination against other universities? It'd be nice to have somebody. I remember when George Bush tried to get Harriet Myers from Southern Methodist on the court. He had great pushback because she supposedly wasn't qualified. Why do you have to be an Ivy Leaguer?
Well, you don't have to be, but there are the great law schools. There's a culture, an atmosphere in the United States that favors the East Coast. I don't think it's a good idea to continue to appoint Harvard Law School or Yale Law School or Columbia Law School graduates to the court. The court needs the likes of an outsider, such as Hugo L. Black was an outsider, did a tremendous job on the court. So I don't care for just appointing Harvard Law School students. Forgive me up there in Boston, but that's my view.
And until Justice Gorsuch, every member was either a Catholic or a Jew.
That's correct.
And that's not reflective of the United States of America.
No, not at all. And I don't know what the religion of Kavanaugh is, but Barrett is a good, devout Catholic.
Very much so. 877-217-5757. Phil in Jefferson Terrace, you're on the air with Professor Beyer.
Good
Good morning, gentlemen. Yes, so where to start? I mean, the court has had such a huge impact from 18 years ago when they basically gave the election to George Bush to the Citizens United decision, which has flooded the electoral process with billions of dollars. And then lately we have Mitch McConnell, who basically is ramrodding his ideology over the whole country.
Is that the way you see it?
Oh, I think Phil is quite right about everything he said, except my views might be different. For instance, I don't read Bush v. Gore as a political triumph. I mean, if you know Bush v. Gore, the court said the Florida Supreme Court had ordered a recount without any kind of rules as to how you count a ballot. So there was an absence of law. I don't read Bush v. Gore as an outsider. I think it's a pretty pronouncement of law. But, Phil, you have good questions.
But the five justices who voted in Bush v. Gore in the majority quite likely voted for George Bush, and the four who voted the other way quite likely voted for Albert Arnold Gore. So,
well, I like the fact, Mr. Engster, that you're beginning to argue with me. That's good.
So, do politics play a role in the court's decisions?
That's an ultimate. I think I'd be blind to reality to say that politics has no room at all. I think it plays a role, but the whole idea is law and politics are separate arenas. That's not a realistic statement, but the moderate contribution is what I'd be interested in, because I do believe there is such a thing as constitutional law. It's not all politics.
Here's a question from Holly in the Garden District about same-sex marriage. Excuse me, this one's about the Affordable Care Act. Is that also potentially in play with a new composition of the court?
I don't think so. I think it was a surprise that Chief Justice Roberts voted to sustain it under the taxing power. We've had it. It's been here for a while. And again, I want to emphasize what Senator Collins is saying. Settled law, stare decisis, it's an element that will probably be within the minds of our new nominee when he gets to the court. As I said to you and others, I don't believe the court will overrule Roe v. Wade. That's my personal experience judgment.
Well, if it were overruled, would it be potentially a 50-state decision, or would it be a state-by-state decision? Either way, it overrules Roe v. Wade, but one would have far more implications than the other.
Well, if Roe is overruled, the whole matter of whether or not liberty in each state embraces the right to procure an abortion would be for each state. And I don't think that in a state such as Louisiana, a woman would be free to procure an abortion.
No, and we would have a Democratic governor likely signing a bill to prohibit
abortions
in Louisiana. And I was a young man, but I do remember before Roe v. Wade in the great state of California, the then Republican governor, Ronald Wilson Reagan, signed a bill giving Californians full abortion rights. At the time, it was the most liberal abortion law in the land, signed by one Ronald Reagan, who put some of these justices on the court who were steadfastly against Roe v. Wade.
Now, Mr. Engster, you're educating me. I didn't know that. Chief Justice Warren condemned apportionment that denied people an equality of vote and strength. But he was asked, why did you do that in the reabortionment cases? And because as a governor, he opposed it. And he said, well, the view up here is different.
Immigration. Last week, the president received a 5-4 decision for his ban on some people from countries that are largely Muslim countries. What do you think?
Well, I would support that decision because it's the president's prerogative, supported by many government officials and secretaries. So I was on the side of President Trump with respect to immigration. The dissents are heated and vituperative. I'm speaking of Justice Sotomayor's dissent. But on balance, I think the court reach the right decision. And then Kennedy, in that case, concurred. It was his valedictory, and in concurring, he points out to an anxious world that the world must know that our government remains committed always to the liberties the Constitution seeks to preserve and protect. I'm reading from his closing recital, so that freedom extends outward and lasts. He must have known that would be his last expression.
Does the Supreme Court have impact on elections?
Well, certainly, because the political world picks up what the court has said is the law. And when the court in Citizens United decided that corporations can spend money to elect people, then what happens is the politics arises to oppose the court's pronouncement. And then if you live long enough, the president can appoint people who will reverse it because they're new justices.
What does your gut tell you about Monday?
My gut tells me about Monday that it will be as exciting as, let's say, France playing Uruguay in today's World Cup. It's like the World Cup. It comes around every few years, and I've watched it, and it's so exciting. But my goodness, President Trump stands out. He's not alone. I mean, Theodore Roosevelt was quite a president with the same kind of bravado as President Trump. So it'll be a fascinating appointment.
Well, we'll follow it with you, and hopefully we'll have you back soon, Dr. Paul Beyer.
I appreciate it, Jim.
And thanks for your service to LSU and to the state of Louisiana, a true treasure, Paul Beyer, who came this way by way of Cincinnati and Harvard University.
Thank you, Jim.
See you soon. And after we take a pause in a few moments, we'll hear from Kevin Lyle, who's back from Broadway, where he won the Tony Award, and his wife, Renee Chatelaine, who's head of the Arts Council of Greater Baton Rouge. And the production on Broadway that won the Tony with Kevin Lyle as producer is Once on This Island, one of the hottest tickets in the world now. And here's a sampling of some work on Once on This Island.
I won't be there to guide your way,
to braid your hair or dry your tears,
as we have done these many years. Timon, Timon, what you are we made you, what we gave.
Of the stranger in white racing
by. Oh gods, are you there?
That's from Once on This Island, and we'll hear from the man who's the producer of this Broadway Tony Award-winning production, Kevin Lyle. He's in studio with Renee Chatelaine, his wife, who happens to be head of the Greater Baton Rouge Arts Council. We're back after this brief pause on WRKF. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us, and you're listening to Talk Louisiana on WRKF. Ali Baltazar is producing, and your number is 877-217-5757. One of the most interesting couples in the United States are in the studio, Kevin Lyle and Renee Chatelaine. Renee has been with us many times, head of the Arts Council, of course, is a lawyer and a dancer of renown. And her husband is Kevin Lyle, who for many years was a businessman in Baton Rouge. He grew up primarily in the Lake Charles area and came to LSU and he stayed in Baton Rouge after graduation, but ran LCR along with his father, Don Lyle, my dear friend, who is quite a man himself. But your company went from $16 million to $450 million this plumbing distribution company before you sold it in 2001. And rather than rest on your laurels, you went off in a totally different direction. You went to Broadway. What was the catalyst for this?
Well, I had been fascinated with Broadway. I saw my first Broadway show when I was 13 years old, and I saw Ben Vereen in the original cast of Pippin, and I was hooked. And as I got older and started to work, I started to make my annual, not annual, probably twice annual, pilgrimages to New York to cram as many Broadway shows into a three-day period as I could do. And so I just stayed very interested, and then I got fascinated in the business model that went along with it. And so after we sold the company and I was doing other things, I had the time to really dig into it and then started investing in it.
80 different investments over the course of the last 15 years or so.
80 different investments, yeah. 83, I think, as of the other day. So it because we have another one opening in July. So,
well, you had some success. They weren't all bombs, as they say. And as you note, sometimes some great work is just not well received, and sometimes maybe some so-so work is a huge hit. You never know. This is an inexact science, isn't it?
Very inexact science. And some of my favorite productions have lost all their money. And the persistence is the key. You just have to keep doing enough of them, and it's a 3 in 10 average that will break even. But when you get one that's a success, it can cover 6 or 7 of the ones that went south. And but you do it because it's really great to see a show evolve and come out and have people impacted by it.
How did Once on This Island? It had been done before, but
done
how
in
did
1990.
How did you get involved? What was the reason why you thought that this one might work?
Well, the lead producer, a gentleman by the name of Ken Davenport, I've worked with. He was one of the first producers I worked with, and he was a very small off-Broadway producer, and I was a very young investor in Broadway, and I've grown with him. He's grown into a very successful lead producer, and I've invested with him for 20 years. And this show, when he shared with me the vision of the director that he had hired, he had a very specific vision for the show, because it's set, although never named, it's set on an island that's been devastated by a storm. And so following the Haiti disaster, he saw reviving this show and basing it as if that was what had happened in Haiti. And then all of the themes of the show about inclusiveness and race relations and caste relations, it all seemed very topical to him. And so I met with him, and he introduced me to the director, and who gave me his visions. Very different. We're doing it in the round, mm-hmm. in a smaller theater with sand and water, just not your typical sort of Broadway production. They look at you really funny when you say, we want to bring in 40 tons of sand into your theater. And so he said, you know, he says, I think this is the one you want to step up and take your first producer credit on. And there are 35 or so of us. I mean, it's not, but Ken is the lead producer, but there are 35 or so of us. It's a team that produces a show like this.
I recall talking to your mother and father about 9 months ago, and they said, Kevin's got this amazing hit on Broadway that you need to go see, but you may have trouble getting a ticket. It is a tough ticket, isn't it?
We have become a much tougher ticket. Winning a Best Revival of a Musical Tony Award will have that very positive effect. So yeah, we're a hard ticket.
Okay. Well, you and Renee, June 10th, less than a month ago, about 4 weeks ago, you're at the Tony Awards ceremony, and the Tonys are as big as the Oscars or the Emmys. It is a huge, huge thing, and for Broadway, it is the Super Bowl. And what happens?
Well, you're right. For those of us in the Broadway world, it is it, and it was you know, you always hear the award people say, well, it's just an honor to be nominated, but it really was pretty surreal to be nominated, and we were up against two very very large, very well funded, very old and popular productions of My Fair Lady and Carousel. And so we were really the little guy, and so in funding, in production budget, the whole thing. But it was really just kind of surreal to be there. But when Christine Baranski opened her mouth and the word "once" came out, all of us in our little section back there knew that we had just won something, And I'm screaming, and Renee's shoving me into the aisle. Go, go, go. And I'm walking down the aisle thinking, don't trip, don't trip, don't trip. But then you get on stage, and you're looking over the crowd, and you're seeing a packed Radio City Music Hall, and you're thinking, man, I don't want to ever perform on this stage. This is pretty frightening.
Yeah. Yeah, that's quite an arena and the ultimate honor. And, Renee, you've been in the business for a long time, and this had to be it had to be quite an event for you as well.
Oh, it was really amazing, and to be in Radio City Music Hall, and it was very glamorous. It really reminded you of when Radio City Music Hall was first built, and all of that sort of Hollywood glamour, and in this case, Broadway. And I was just so proud of Kevin, and proud to be in that crowd, and amongst the energy was really wonderful. Everybody was happy for everyone else, and cheering everybody on. It was really a great evening. And of course, when you win, it's even better.
And independent of this, among your investments, another play you invested in, it was the huge winner of almost all the awards.
Yeah, we won 10 of 11 that we were nominated in the best musical category. It's another smaller kind of non-traditional Broadway musical called The Band's Visit. And Tony Shalhoub and Katrina Link star in it, and they both won Tony Awards as well. And it started, I'm on the board of directors of the nonprofit theater, the Atlantic Theater Company in New York. And so we produce off-Broadway shows. And every once in a while, we did Spring Awakening a number of years ago, and it moved to Broadway. And when this show came out in our theater a couple of years ago, some producers came in and said, hey, you know, we think we can – it's a very small show, and most theaters are much larger, and so, but we think we can make it work and translate it to a larger theater. So we were thrilled that they did it, and I was able to invest in that. And we had a night like doesn't happen very often.
Yeah, so you were the big winner when it comes to two victories. But a producer, that's another level. What does a producer do on Broadway?
Well, there are two levels of producers. There's the lead producer, and he's carrying the water. He's doing all of the work. He's making all of the deals and working with all the creative people. And then there are those of us who are co-producers who are mainly involved in the business aspects of it. So we meet and discuss the marketing and the advertising, and we spend a lot of time figuring out how to mount a Tony campaign for the show, because it's 842 people who decide who wins a Tony Award, and it's marketing to figure out how to get those people in your seats and watch your show and think, hey, we should vote for you over the big guys.
Mm-hmm. What do you do next?
I have a totally different show opening in July called Getting the Band Back Together, and it's kind of a comedy farce. It's set in the 80s where a young man gets fired from his job as a stockbroker and goes back home to live with his mother and decides he wants to get the band, his high school band, back together to win the band dueling bands that they lost 30 years ago. And so it really is just campy fun.
Well, next to an athletic event, there's nothing like going to a play and having sometimes famous, sometimes not so famous people on stage giving it everything they've got night after night and not knowing how the audience is going to respond. And opening night has to be a harrowing thing.
It is in many ways, but also, you know, on opening night, you've got a supportive audience, which is when you want it, because you're really putting it out there for the first time. You've done previews, so you've done your warm-ups, but opening night is a lot of fun, and you get to see the show with everyone who's worked so hard to put it on, and you get a look at what it might do.
Do the critics still come on opening night?
Actually, they don't. They come in the days leading up to opening night, and then they all publish on opening night about 11 p.m. And with the old days of waiting for the newspaper to be delivered are long gone. And so on the internet, by about 11 o'clock, you've got 30 different folks who've reviewed your show, and you're waiting to see what they're going to say.
Well, both you and Renee are tied to this community. I hope you stay. Renee, Kevin, you're going to stay here a while, or is it going to be full-time Broadway now?
Well, you know, we love Baton Rouge. And as a matter of fact, I choreographed once on this island for two local productions here. And so when he was talking about investing, it was really very close to my heart, but there's so much great activity going on here, and there are wonderful artists here. And so while we love New York, we want to duly promote them.
Well, we hope you stay. And congratulations to both of you.
Thank you very much.
Keep up the good work. Thanks. Kevin Lyle, Renee Chatelain. We're back Monday, same time. Stay tuned.
For a podcast of today's show, go to WRKF.org or find the Talk Louisiana podcast on the WRKF app. We welcome your feedback and topic suggestions. Email